So do you hear me? I guess so. Hello, everybody. So I have the pleasure to give this talk about stars and stellar dynamo. So this work is done with a lot of people, Yuri Toumré, that you all know well, Marc Misch, some grad students, Ben Brown, Lauren Jouve, Nick Featherston, Kyle Augustin, Nicole Nelson, some postdoc, Matt Browning, and Anna Palacio. So I'm going to give you some a brief introduction on what are the evidences for stellar magnetism, and then some simulation we have been doing in this group. So I will try to be as exhaustive as possible. Okay. So we all know that the Sun is magnetic, and that's one of the reasons we are here. So we know that there is a butterfly diagram. So sunspot emerge at a latitude of 30 degrees north and south and migrate on an even year cycle. And you have a nice movie here taken by the Solar Swedish Telescope where you see the interaction between convection and magnetism. And we could also see that when you look at the magnetogram of the Sun, you can have some active belt linked to the magnetogram and the butterfly diagram, and some salt and pepper, which is perhaps more linked to, let's say, small-scale dynamo action. So there is certainly a paradigm right now in the stellar-solar dynamo community that the Sun has to drive two types of dynamo, small-scale one for the salt and pepper effect and a large-scale one for the ordered cycle of 11 years. So the other thing that has very important for the last 15 years, that helioseismology has given us a very important information, i.e. that what is the rotation profile within the Sun. And so we know that the Sun is rotating on cones at mid-latitude with almost no variation with radius, and then it turns into a solid body rotation. And so the transition is called the tachocline, but we also have some evidence for a shear layer. And so explaining this differential rotation, this peculiar differential rotation, is not easy. I'm going to go the other way. I guess we have the microphone. Okay, so we know from recent observations that you could have also, as a function of the solar cycles, for the 11-year cycle, we can have modulation of the strength of the differential rotation. So there is also torsional oscillation, but you have also a modulation of the differential rotation, and that we believe, I will show in the model, that is due to the Maxwell stresses acting on the redistribution of angular momentum, and so you could have some a kind of a breathing of the differential rotation with the magnetic cycle. And now if you look at the meridional flow, which is now differential rotation is the one going longitudinally, and the meridional flow is the one going through the poles. So here you have a map where you see you have on yellow, red, and green, this is a magnetogram again, where you see active regions. And in blue, these are arrows of the meridional flow deduced through what we call local helioseismology and the ring diagram analysis. This work was done by Deborah Haber in Yuri's group. And you can see that active region can deform the meridional flow, which otherwise is kind of poleward, at least to some extent, in latitude. When you look at the function of depth and not just at the surface now, you can see that indeed it's poleward mostly, but sometimes with as a cycle, so here this is 1996, as we go up during the last solar cycle, cycle 23, we find that there could exist some counter cells due to magnetic activity. And recent work by Mike Thompson and a postdoc of his, they have tried to invert what the meridional flow will be as a function of depth. So here we are at the surface, and you look, and you have one reversal and the second one. So you could consider that as being a multicellular meridional flow as a function of depth. So you see that you could have both multicells in latitude and in depth. And even more recent work by Zwanda et al. Have tried to assess what are the perturbations of the meridional flow with magnetic field. And as you take the unsigned magnetic flux as a function of stronger and stronger active region, or larger and larger active region, let's say, you find that you can have deviation up to 2 meters per second. knowing that the meridional flow is about 20 meters per second. So here, this is a picture, it perhaps don't show very well, of the Sun during solar cycle 22. And as all of you know very well, it is active. But what's very striking is that the Sun is even more active during in different lights. In visible light, we don't see, we see just a very small variation. The total irradiance varies by less than 0.1% over the cycle. But in X-ray, equal soft X-ray, can vary up to 50 times. So it's much more. And clearly, the X-ray, soft X-rays, are a very good proxy to assess what is the magnetic activity of other stars than one of the proxy. And when you actually do that, that's a work by Schmidt, when you using the Rosat All Sky Survey, but also more recent stuff by Espadon, I will come to that later, and you plot as a function of the spectral type, so the Sun, for the one who doesn't know, is the G star, kind of a dwarf star. As you go down this way, you become you have a thicker and thicker convection zone, up to the spectral type N3, where you become fully convective. And as you go back this way, we will see in the other plots, you have a thinner and thinner and shallower convection zone. And then the convection shifts into the core, and you have mostly a radiative envelope. And as you can see, when the convection shifts, and we'll see that in the next plot, you seem to have much less detection of stars that have X-ray, and so strong X-ray luminosity. And so we call that the A gap. And we have to understand the increase in the O. These O stars are so massive, and some of them, the blue giants, are so hot that they emit a lot in X-ray. And you could also have they have a strong stellar wind, radiatively driven, and you can have reconnection in the O stars in their wind. So it's difficult to say if it's activity due to stellar dynamo or if it's just X-ray reconnection in the wind. So anyway, here you have some reconstruction due to this nice instrument called Espadon, where you have actually, you start to have the magnetic field topology. So as I was saying, when you look at stars and you build simple 1D models, you find that there is a transition between convection and envelope around 1.3 solar mass, and mostly the massive stars are driven by what we call the CNO cycle. So it's not the standard PP chain like in the Sun, and this one depends much more on temperature. So you have a lot, and the reason for that is that these stars have a lot of energy generation, they are hot, and they produce so much heat that the radiation cannot carry it away, and the core has to start convecting to be able to help carrying the flux outward. So as you go to lower masses, you become fully convective, as I said. So we can have a picture here where you expect certainly change in the stellar magnetism and also in the activity of these stars as a function of their mass just because the convection zone disappears from the surface. So when you look a little bit more in detail, and there were this wonderful work started by Wilson in 1978 and continues by Balunas and others, you start looking at different stars from the F, G, and K type, and you look for solar cycle. You can ask stellar cycle. You can ask yourself how frequent and often stellar cycles appears in other stars. And here, this is the Sun, looking the same type of way, using calcium 2 H and K lines. Sorry, and you do see that the Sun solar cycle, well, 10 years here. And you look at other stars, and you do find that there are other stars that have cycles. And of the 111 stars in this HK project from F2 to M2 type, 31 show a flat or linear signal, 29 are irregular variables, and 51 plus the Sun possess magnetic cycles. So it's interesting to see that the Sun, there is a solar-stellar connection, which is interesting. And when you plot that as the inverse of the cycle period, a function of a kind of a Rossby number, you do seem to find some correlation. This is not completely obvious, and I will come to that in that next plot. So that's a work done by Saar and Brandenburg and continued by Steve Saar. When you start plotting as a function of the Rossby number and the cycle period, and you try to see how they scale, or you see different trends. Let's look at this one in particular, cycle as a function of the rotation rate. You do find that there are branches. If you forget about these branches and you collapse all the data, you find that the cycle period varies as a function of a weak function of the rotation rate. So as the star rotates faster, the cycle period reduces. But you do find that inactive star, by inactive, they mean less active than young stars, so their calcium emission is weaker. You do see a trend, a general trend of increase of the periodicity. So anyway, so recently, and even more recently, that will be my last slide on observation, there will be a work on solar analogs with the Espadon project, done by Jean-François Donati and Pascal Petit in Toulouse. And they have done this work where they have tried to find stars that are very close to the Sun, except perhaps HD 76151, which is a bit more massive, but there are some issues on the mass of this star. You find that these stars, as the rotation rate decreases, seems to be getting more and more magnetic field. And here you have the distribution of the function of the mean field in Gauss. And as they rotate faster, they got a more important magnetic flux. And you can see that the contribution from poloidal energy to this mean, to the field they are reconstructing, is reducing. And so it seems that the magnetic field, as the star rotates faster and faster, become more toroidal. So here are some of their maps. This is the radial field, the azimuthal field, and the meridional field. And so you see that this is a star rotating about the Sun rate slightly faster. And as you increase the rotation rate, you start getting more and more of the azimuthal field and stronger bands and a dominance. So there is this trend that as you increase the rotation rate in these stars, they start generating more and more toroidal field. They are quite confident that I was actually the referee of the paper, so we discussed quite a lot about that. And so now we are, the key chi-square fit are quite good, and they did several tests. So this is a picture. They understood a lot of magnetic activity and a very nice work, and the observation are becoming more and more constraining. So you need to get a picture. And if you start modeling all the stars, if you want to evolve a star for giga years with a 3D code, you are going to be in trouble, certainly. So we have been in a community, and it's more or less history like that, so early days, the 80s, and now the current approach, but we are still going on, of how do you model stars? So there are many approaches. Of course, the first 1D secular approach consists of building 1D standard microscopic models, and you treat convection by mixing length. Mixing length is very basic. You take a blob of hot gas, you move it at a certain distance, it releases heat, and you do that. So it's a very simple way of treating convection, and we know it's turbulent, there is a spectra, and this is completely ignored. Then you can go to a more recent set of models, and one of my colleagues, Stéphane Matisse, is doing that heavily now, including rotation and what we will call secular MHD. Secular MHD is just you take the basic equation and you look at how they perturb the hydrostatic equilibrium, and you do take into account some mixing and redistribution of angular momentum, but only taking into account the large Kelvin field and not the Maxwell stresses, let's say. So then you have, of course, the 2D mean field approach, and this one is very famous in the dynamo community. So you have the first set of models we will call kinetic mean field dynamo models, either of the alpha omega or Bacot-Clayton flux transport type. I will discuss a little bit more of that. And also, of course, non-linear mean field models. So this, you assume that instead of prescribing the flows, you have either the lambda effect, which is in the movements of Günther Rüdiger, and you take into account what is called the Malkus-Rockter feedback. Again, this is a large-scale magnetic field acting back on the fluctuating Navier-Stokes equation in order to get some nonlinear feedback and saturation, where here the saturation is put by hand. Here you got it naturally from the feedback. So then you move to 3D, more recent stuff, and you got local box simulation. So you have the high resolution, a high level of turbulence, but you lack global effect, let's say. You can do another approach, consists of doing a stars-in-a-box approach. So you have no center problem, but perhaps it's more complicated to define the outer boundary and to do some interpolation of the field. So that can be a bit special. And of course, you have stars in sphere or spherical shells. You got the correct topology, you have the mean flows, but of course, you are less turbulent. So I'm not going to talk all about that. I'm going just to focus on the blue line here, because that's the work we have been doing with our colleagues. So here, let's take a sphere, let's put a perfect gas, let's rotate the sphere and make it convex, and we get this kind of typical banana cells type of convection flow. Blue is downflows here, and yellow is upflows, and they are tilted because there is a correlation, and that's work has been done for many years by Gary Glassmeyer and Peter Gumman initially, and we have continued the work. And as you increase the degree of turbulence, you are becoming more and more cyclonic. Your downflow lines become thinner. You still have some curve of this downflow line, but you are becoming more isotropic near the polar cap. And as you can see, some of these structures pierce through the whole convective domain, and they are called turbulent plumes and convective plumes. I'm not sure they are turbulent in our models, but at least they are plumes. When you take a cut through the sphere and you make a temporal average and you compare with the observation, some of the models we are computing are getting the job correctly. They are fast equator, slow pole, some constancy at mean latitude. This is not perfect. We have better models than that. And you have a density contrast of about 30%. So when you are on the sun sitting, let's say the sun is a merry-go-round, you sit at the equator, you will make four turns. By the time your friend sitting on the merry-go-round on the polar region will make three turns only. So you see you have a significant amount of shear in the sun. And when you look at... It's a nice merry-go-round. It's hot, that's all. You need steel pants or something like that. So here, when you look at the meridional flow, again, we do find that we are poleward near the surface, and we find some multicellular flow. Oh, so recently, I will show you, we have a model that doesn't show that, show more of one big cell, but let's say that this flow is fluctuating a lot, and it's very difficult to, on a given snapshot, there is not one single cell, but when you look on longer temporal averages. So don't want to bother too much with equations, so let's forget about that. I just want to say that how do you explain the differential rotation in the sun? So with the choice of boundary condition we have done, you can divide your transport of angular momentum in different terms, the hydro part, viscous, Reynolds stresses and meridional flow, and two magnetic parts, Maxwell stresses and large-scale magnetic torque. So when you look at, in the purely hydro case, at least in these more laminar models, you find that the Reynolds stresses are transporting the angular momentum, this is a function of radius, toward from the bottom toward the top of the shell, and in latitude, this is a function of latitude, you find that the Reynolds stresses are transporting the angular momentum from the pole toward the equator. So the acceleration is due to angular momentum transport by the Reynolds stresses. And the and depending on the amplitude of your viscous stresses, in this latitudinal balance, they are weak. In this radial balance, in that specific model, they are quite large. The meridional flow will adapt in order to get the balance right. This solid line here is just to mean that we are in balance and there are no net flux. Now, but at the beginning of the simulation, of course, you start all the process and it's in balance. So you could also wonder what we call Taylor-Prudhomme theorem and thermal wind. So since we are in a rotating sphere of gas, we know that there is Taylor-Prudhomme constraint on the flow. And if you take the curl of the momentum equation, you got a bunch of terms. And if you say, okay, all of them are 0 and I keep just this one, you find that you will be constant along cylinders. So you will get quasi-2D flows, a bit like the Bussy column. But if you don't neglect this, for example, this baroclinic term, but also Reynolds stresses and other time, you can demonstrate that you can have departure from cylinders by having what we call a thermal wind or baroclinic effect and the latitudinal variation of the entropy and temperature. So when you look at one of the models, and this is V5, the meridian, you take the derivative of V5 along the z-axis, you compute the thermal wind, and you make the difference between the two maps. You do find some differences, but you also find that they are in agreement in the bulk of the convection zone. So these models we are finding, they are in a reasonable thermal wind balance. It's not perfect. There are significant departures in certain locations, and you confirm that differential rotation, the equator is fast because of the Reynolds stresses. Now the thermal wind is going to help you bend the isocontours of omega. So just before going that, I want to show you the latitudinal heat flux balance. So this is a complicated curve, so bear with me 2 seconds. So if you look at this curve here, this solid line curve, this is the enthalpy flux. By that I mean the correlation between the latitudinal velocity and T prime. So something like rho bar Cp, this term. So correlation between the temperature fluctuation and the velocity. And this is what makes the poles hot. So what we find in this simulation is that the poles are hotter than the equator, and the transport of heat is due mostly by convection. And of course, opposed by that, you have a transport, diffusive transport proportional to the entropy gradient, and that opposes, and you get almost zero. And then you have a bunch of other terms. So what we find for now in this simulation, that the meridional flow doesn't seem to be playing a big role in transporting the heat in the model. It seems that they play a bigger role in transporting the angular momentum. Okay, but this is still a work in progress. So when you actually look, you do different test models, and that has also been done by Matthias Rempel. So when you impose no variation of the, let's play with the thermal boundary conditions. So you modify the thermal boundary condition in your model. You say, okay, that's the first model I show you. I do nothing. I got 9 degree K of variation. So the thermal wind is associated with 9 degree K. So now you modify the boundary condition. You assume that this A2 and A4 are zero. You have no variation of the entropy. And you find just 3K, and you are mostly on cylinders. As you increase the forcing, you become more and more horizontal to a point where if you force too much in these laminar models, you become almost horizontal. So it seems that the best case to get the cones, like we find in the sun, would be about 10 degree K with respect to 9. So we are not too far. So we see that the latitudinal heat transport by convection can almost establish enough temperature contrast, but we are just a little bit short of few degree K. So and in more turbulent model, this is not as obvious. This is kind of a laminar model, so diffusion is working well. But anyway, this gives you a sense that I recall you that at the base of the convection zone, the temperature is 2.2 million degrees. So we are speaking of very small perturbations here. So now we go to higher resolution. We push the resolution, and that's the work we have done with Mark Mish and Yuri and Mark DeRosa from Lockheed Martin. And as you increase the resolution, but more importantly, as you increase the density contrast in the simulation, and you go from a density contrast of 40 to a density contrast of 150, you get more and more structures, and you see less and less of the banana cells. And this is a temperature map, and you see that all the spinners, all these cyclones that you are getting in the simulation have cold spinners associated with them. And you see this band, which is the M equals zero structure, is a thermal wind that I spoke about. So you have this thermal wind, and on top of this thermal wind, you have all this fluctuation and correlation of convection between the radial velocity and the temperature fluctuation, of course, that transports the heat outward on the convection zone. And that's a movie of what you can see of the cliving, merging, and of the structures. I'm sure Mark has a much nicer movie than me for that one, but that's one way of seeing. And here you see down below that you have more of this alignment, excuse me, of the cells, down flow lanes with the rotation axis. So anyway, just to I need to move on if I don't want to be too lost on time. So this is a differential rotation we are getting in this model. It's not as nice, but as you can see, we get a meridional flow, which seems to be more unicellular, modulo, two counter cells at the boundary layer. But when you look at the time evolution, a snapshot of this meridional flow, you can see that it fluctuates significantly around the mean. So you need to take long temporal averages to start getting some structure emerging on average. So as I said, I'm going to speak a little bit of 2D models, and now I want that's the convection part. Now we want to put magnetic field, and this is the standard what we call Babcock-Leighton model. You have a big, large-scale unicellular flow, but I just told you that in our models it depends if you can really consider that. So large-scale meridional flow, convection zone, Tacco-Klein, this little zone here, and you put a magnetic field. I forgot to put some in loop. The movie. So, and you have advection of the poloidal field and the shearing of the biomega effect in the Tacco-Klein, and you start getting a butterfly diagram and a 22-year cycle. That's a work by my PhD student, and we also have a benchmark. But what we did with my PhD student was to put multicellular. So since in the 3D models, in some of the observation, we do seem to have multicells, we computed models where we put multicellular flow, and we try to look what happens. And so the field gets advected, and you get a different butterfly diagram and a much a slowdown of the cycle period. So it seems that having more cells in radius slow down quite significantly the cycle. So if the sun has multi-cells in radius, you expect them to not persist for too long, because otherwise you will see it quite significantly in the butterfly diagram. So this is just interesting to look at. So when we put magnetic field in 3D models, we will get dynamo action or not, depending on our magnetic Reynolds number. And what we find is that the radial component of the magnetic field is swept to the downflow lanes. As the flow diverges at the surface, it swept the magnetic field line, and you get a lot of reconnection in the downflow lanes. This is less true for the horizontal field. This is B theta and B phi. They are more like unipolar. And this is, for example, a movie where you see the 3D rendering of the magnetic field lines, and you see nice ribbon of fields. I'm going to have to skip. So as a function of the magnetic Reynolds number, you got a failed dynamo, or just one which, that is marginal, or one that rise, saturate non-linearly, and have a feedback on the kinetic energy. This is magnetic energy, and this is kinetic energy. And we find that for a magnetic Prandtl greater than one, it seems that the Reynolds number is around 300. And when you reduce the magnetic Prandtl number, it's harder to get it. And so, as I wanted to point out, when the magnetic energy grows, what you find is that you have a feedback of the magnetic field and the full Maxwell stresses on the differential rotation mostly. Not much on the convection, much more on the differential rotation, and you quench the omega, the differential rotation. So that's a movie of a low PM simulation, but I don't have really the time of discussing about it. So we are starting to try to compute, so low PM for us means 0.8, so difficult, you understand. I mean, at the solar rate, of course, when you increase the solar rate, the rotation rate, we can go much below. But at the solar rate, getting less than one is very hard. And these are field line reconstruction through the convection domain and extrapolation in the corona. And you see it's quite messy in the convection zone, and then you can have trans-equatorial loops, and this is very nice. So the magnetic field is mostly fluctuating in that simulation. So here, when you put the magnetic field and you look at the differential, this model is not perfect. It's more cylindrical. But what's important is that plot here. the dashed line are the magnetized case with versus the solid line of the purely hydrodynamical case. And you see that there is a quenching of the differential rotation by about 30% due to the Lorentz force. And in this cartoon plot, I've tried to summarize all the agents, Reynolds stresses, meridional flow, viscous torque, Maxwell stresses, large scale magnetic scale torque. And mostly what the guy who's doing the trick to accelerate the equator is the Reynolds stress, and he has to fight against everybody else to maintain the differential rotation. And Maxwell stresses are playing, magnetic field try to make it the sphere rotate solidly. So we have done recently a nice work implementing a Tacco-Klein and a stable layer, but that I'm going to not speak about because Yuri is going to speak about it, okay? So this afternoon you will hear more about what is the influence of the Tacco-Klein in dynamo generation in this convective sphere. You can also model not only the convection zone, but you can also try to model the radiative interior, so the convection zone will be on top. That's the work I have done with Jean-Paul Zahn. And you can look at the influence of a fossile field on how the differential the rotation is or not solid at the bottom in the radiative interior. And it seems that it's very complicated and depends heavily on how the field lines are anchoring or not in a shear in a convection zone. So here we had an impenetrable wall, and perhaps if we had a more realistic convection zone as a boundary condition, we will have a less efficient anchoring of the field lines and less transport of angular momentum. And what was very interesting in this simulation, since they were in 3D, is that we have found a bunch of non-axis symmetric magnetic instabilities, and they grow. First, the poloidal one grows at high M, then saturate, and then you have the M equal 1 Taylor instability that develop at the pole through the shearing effect of the shear and poloidal field. And so you can wonder, is there a dynamo in the radiative interior of the sun? It is very interesting, and it's a very hot topic, and we are all working on that to understand if it's possible to close the loop with this kind of instabilities. So recently, we have been doing even deeper type of models where you start having a very extended radiative zone. So here's the convection zone with overshoot. Here you have some of the nuclear region. So I'm starting to model the sun in 3D, the differential rotation. It's almost no rotation here. And you can start looking at convection and how they generate waves. This is a density perturbation and how the waves will propagate. That's the work also Gary and Tammy Rogers are doing. So we are working in trying to understand what are the effects of gravity waves. And this is a 3D rendering of the waves in the sphere where I've cut the northern hemisphere, trying to see how these waves are propagating in the radiative interior and how they actually transport angular momentum, and etc. So quickly, this is a picture of the sun, summarizing the sun, more or less. So that's a piece, it's a spherical version of Nick Brummel's cartoon with some addition from my part. So you have convection operating, generating magnetic field. This magnetic field is either pumped through the turbulent magnetic pumping or advected by meridional flow into the Tacco-Klein. The Tacco-Klein has a strong shear. It generates toroidal structures. These toroidal structures may emerge from instability, buoyancy, and either be recycled in the convection zone or emerge as active regions. And you can also have certainly interaction with, you have internal waves, acoustic waves, but internal waves and fossile fields can interact within the radiative interior. And that's currently the theoretical view we have of the sun, what's going on, and how we have been studying each process, either in local simulation or in global simulation. So now in the last, 10 minutes or so, or 5 minutes or so, I'm going to discuss the what we have done in other stars. 10 minutes left. There are 15, perhaps. For questions. Okay. Okay. So this is the simulation of a fastly rotating sun. So as you see, we have solar analogs. We are starting to have observation of solar analogs. So that's a work done by Ben Brown for his PhD. And we have been publishing several papers. So when you increase the rotation rate of, let's say, mildly turbulent simulation, you increase the rotation rate and you start to get modulated convection, and you start to get much thinner scales, and you excite higher ends in convective holes, and you also get some evolution of the differential rotation with delta omega and the meridional flow. So this is summarized in this plot. So as a function of omega, the delta omega over omega has kind of a plateau and then decreases. And you can also look at the meridional velocity. And what's very striking, we can also understand it, but I think a lot of people were not expecting that. People were thinking that as you make the star rotate faster, it will have a faster meridional flow. It doesn't. It has a weaker meridional flow. So that makes a lot of constraint on the Babcock-Leighton flux transport model to explain what you observe for the relation between solar cycle and the rotation rate. Because as you make it rotate fast, slower the meridional flow, the cycle will be weak, slower also. So in these Babcock-Leighton models, they seem to work quite well for the sun, but they seem to be in trouble for faster rotating stars to explain what we observe. And we're working with that with my student and Ben Brown as well. So we have also put magnetic field in these simulations, and Yuri will also speak about that. Nice strong reefs of magnetic field amidst convection. And I advise you to look at Ben's and Kyle Augustin posters. Kyle has been working on F-stars and Ben on G-stars and how rotation influence that. I've also worked with a French PhD student, Jérôme Ballot, who's now a postdoc, on thicker, younger suns, 10 million years old suns, where you have a much thicker convection zone. And we do find the same kind of trend that the meridional flow decreases with the angular velocity. And you get multicellular and very complex meridional flow. But that's perhaps a bias of the model. But the weaker flow, I don't think so. So then we also computed the massive stars. Excuse me, I'm going just through a lot of stars here, but just to give you a flavor of what we have been doing. So we have been modeling these convective stars, as convective core stars. As I said, massive stars have a convective core and a radiative envelope. So we have started modeling these stars with Matthew Browning during his PhD, and now also with Nick Featherstone. And Nick will discuss about more recent work on A-stars in his talk this afternoon. So we put a heating source down. We have done several rotation rates. These stars are 20 times more luminous than the sun. And here is, for example, a movie of the throbbing heart of the convective core. And blue is downflows and red is downflows. And you see that there is a differential rotation in these cores and large scale and convection. So when you put magnetic field in this simulation, it grows. It's even more efficient in this connected convective core to establish dynamos than it is in a solar case. And you get, again, the feedback of the Lorentz force on the differential rotation. So about the same graph trends that are very similar. Well, this figure doesn't show very well, but you see this is the convective velocity, radial velocity, and when this is B-phi. And you see that the omega effect is wrapping up the field lines and generating a kind of a wool of a ball of magnetic wool or whatever, magnetic shred. And again, as I said, for the differential rotation, when you look at a cut of the meridional flow and you have when you have no magnetic field, you have a significant amount of shear in the convection zone, but not much in a radiative interior. Envelope, excuse me, and when you put magnetic field, you quench the differential rotation significantly, and as you rotate faster at 4 times solar rotation rate, then from a very nice differentially rotating convective core, you go to almost no rotation. So really, we know that magnetic energy scale with the rotation rate, and you start killing everything, and this is very interesting. And this simulation can also have periodicity with the feedback between convection and magnetic energy. So I'm going to finish on this last simulation we have been doing with Napalacio, which are RGB stars, more massive stars. So these stars are very important. We need to understand the angular momentum transport in these stars, because when they go to the bump, as they go up to the asymptotic branch and go up, so this star is 425, the solar luminosity, 40 times the solar radius, 0.8 times the solar mass, because he has lost his mass for solar wind during its evolution. We have been computing different models, a tenth of the solar rate or a 50th of the solar rate, because this rotates very slowly. I'm almost there. And so forget about that. And these are the kind of things you are getting, convection. If you increase the level of turbulence, you get more and more structure, and these are very big extended convection zone. I want to point you to this value. We get values that are about 10 times more for the velocity and 10 times more for the temperature fluctuation. You need to carry 400 times more luminosity than the sun, so you need to have much more, much stronger flow and much stronger fluctuation. But what's very striking in the recent model we have been doing, that was what we were getting at one-tenth the solar rate. We were getting cylinders. It was kind of boring. As you make it rotate 150th, we get what we call Shelley-Lah rotation. So this is very neat. And we get this kind of... So we still have a strong radial variation, but no more cylinders. This star is rotating so slowly that it doesn't feel Taylor-Prudhomme anymore. And so you get on a shell like that. And I think that was pretty much, yeah. And that's a project, a European project I'm leading now called STARS 2 project, and I'm looking for postdocs. And we are starting to look at trying to map the HR diagram with different types of 3D models. And I will stop here. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure there are lots of questions, so. Beranger, I think, got there first.
Yes, at the beginning you showed us an observational diagram of a period of dynamo as a function of Rossby number. Are you able to reproduce this diagram with your models?
Also, as I said, it was one of the comments I made with the Bacot-Layton models. I think the Bacot-Layton models are in trouble with that plot. Because if we believe our 3D models, the meridional flow should weaken. And if the meridional flow weakens, then you should have something completely reverse of what we are seeing. I mean, the cycle should be longer, and we find that it's slightly faster. So when you do alpha omega models, it seems that you can explain part of that, but Axel has also looked at that, so he can. So with alpha omega models, I think you can explain some of the trends, but clearly with the current paradigm for the solar dynamo model, which is Bacot-Layton flux transport, I think you are in trouble there, and we are working on that.
Okay, it's just one there.
So just a comment on that, the Babcock-Layton model has two mechanisms for flux transport to the pole. One is the meridional circulation, and the other is turbulent diffusion. So it's not entirely clear that if you reduce the weak meridional circulation slightly, you would end up with a slower transport to the pole.
Yeah, except that, let me answer that, you want to stay in the advective-dominated regime in this model, okay? So if you crank up your diffusivity to the point where you are no more what we call advectively-dominated in this model, then you are actually squeezing the meridional flow, and you are doing a dynamo which is due to the field is transported by diffusion, and that's not what you want to do. You always want to stay in the advection-dominated regime, and so that gives you a constraint on your diffusion. Okay, so that's why it's not completely obvious, but of course.
Okay, I think Anvar got there next.
Yeah. Sasha, you promised to discuss the role of Tarkoglian we discussed later, but still, you discussed quite subtle features of the solutions, like thermal winds, meridional circulation. Do you imply that all these features you presented are insensitive, independent of the presence of Tarkoglian?
No, actually, when I showed this plot where I was looking at the influence of when you look at that, that was to try to take from an easy way. Let's say, when we do this model with penetration, It's difficult to make the stiffness, the real stiffness, I mean the high Peclet number of the sun, okay? So VL over kappa. So we have to fudge a little bit with the real jump in entropy gradient that we have in the convection, in the radiative zone. So right now the models we are able to do, and we are working on that with Yuri, Mark and others, we have some issues with the way when we put a real stable layer in the way it feedback on the convection zone. We have too much, I think, we think, viscous coupling between the two zones. Okay, so what we have done, and following some work done by Matthias Rempel, was to impose a variation of the latitudinal gradient here, because we think that in this thermal wind balance here, you see there is a dV phi over dZ. So V phi varies in latitude a lot in convection and not much in radius, but it's the reverse. It varies a lot in radius and not much in latitude in the tachocline. Okay? So in this dV phi over dZ, you could see that as a way of seeing it as a two contribution. One contribution coming from the convection zone and one contribution coming from the tachocline. And that you could have actually variation and the thermal wind balance, which will be a bit different in the two zones, if you want. And that, so what we have done in this model where we are enforcing is trying to add in the model the influence of the tachocline. But as I pointed out, and that's a discussion we have been having with Matthias, I think there are differences in as you increase the level of turbulence. I think that the fact that these models are working very well in to explain the conicity of the profile is also in part because we are in this model dominated a bit by diffusion, and so it's easy to propagate the what you're imposing at the boundary condition within the convection zone. In the more turbulent cases, what we are finding, it's much harder to do that effect because you have the V dot grad term in the equation of the of the entropy, the V dot grad term is perturbating what does the kappa rho, the rho bar, T bar, kappa, grad S. You see, this term is working very well in laminar cases and propagates the gradient of S within the convection zone and changing the contours. But in our turbulent cases, this V dot grad S is playing a lot and it seems to perturb that balance. And I think there is, as I said, enthalpy flux, latitudinal enthalpy flux by convection. So it's not completely obvious to me that the convection zone by itself could not establish the delta T or delta S it needs just by redistribution of heat by turbulent convection. The fact is that our models are limited to some extent to what we can reach in terms of turbulent heat transport. And so we have to think that the tachocline is playing a role, perhaps 20%, 25% of the overall delta S, but that we need to be checked as we increase the level of turbulence. So it's very subtle.
Okay, Axel?
Two comments. First on Berenger's question regarding the possible explanations of the increase of the cycle periods with increasing Rossby number. Based on linear theory and homogeneous dynamo waves, in the nonlinear regime, one may expect that the omega cycle over rotation frequency ratio is a proxy of the alpha effect, and the inverse Rossby number is a proxy of the magnetic field strength. And so that suggests directly that the uprise may have to do with an increase of the alpha effect with magnetic field strength. Mm-hmm. So this is the only proposal that I know of that really is potentially able to explain that. But such a mechanism has not been found yet. Secondly, you said you were thinking that many people were surprised that the meridional circulation increases with increasing angular velocity.
No, there have been models published with that where they were taking Vm proportional to
who published that?
Mosumi Dikpati, for example.
Obviously everybody who knows about the Taylor-Proudman theorem must know otherwise. I mean, it should go down.
No.
The only surprise is that it actually does go up in the beginning, and that's when the Taylor number is not big enough. So can you maybe show us again, at which point did you see the maximum of the Taylor number? We had models back in the early 90s, and we found this at around 10 to the few times 10 to the 6 for the Taylor number.
We have the Taylor number. But no, I agree with you that when you look at the equation,
yes.
It's but
yes, on the left,
they were
yeah.
in the omega people over, were saying you were not to increase with omega and it's not.
So it's between 1 and 2, 1.5 and 2.
No, this is the meridional flow. Yeah, here it's about constant and then it decreases. So we don't see exactly the same. But we compare to some of the results by Kuker and Rüdiger, and I think the 3D model doesn't agree completely with the 2D models. We have some discrepancies, but perhaps because we have the real renal stresses and not just the lambda effect, you see.
Katia.
Yeah, just a very short comment. You said that once you add the magnetic field in your simulations and the field gets strong enough, then it will have a back reaction on the large-scale meridional flow, right?
Circulation. Differential rotation, not meridional flow.
On the large-scale differential rotation, but not so much on the small-scale convection motions, right?
You see some effect, but it's not striking.
I was going to say that in the galaxy, it's exactly the opposite. When you have magnetic fields, they will have an effect on the small-scale turbulent motions, but very little on the large-scale rotation. So it's pretty different. Yeah.
Okay, but perhaps because the rotation is driven by something. I mean, perhaps the history of the star of the galaxy rotating.
Yeah.
Where here the differential rotation in the convection zone is maintained continuously by Reynolds stresses. So if you offset that balance, then you quench it much, much easier. Okay. Where here in your galaxy, I think that's more angular conservation from the formation of the galaxy itself. You know. So it's, I think that's the reason why.
Okay, just one more, perhaps.
So, do you think it's possible in the long run to get some kind of textbook level scaling as to how much of the differential rotation energy, how much of the convective energy, as a function of the, say, global rotation and density profile, goes into differential rotation and then perhaps magnetic field? In other words,
So we are starting to do that. We have this big program where we expect to take all our simulations and make a paper which makes a synthesis of that. So this will be a massive paper with everybody in the group. But right now, what I can tell you is that in the sun, about 50 to 60% of the energy, of the convection energy, kinetic energy, goes in a differential rotation, about 40% in the convection. I mean, non-axisymmetric motion, let's say, and just perhaps 0.5% in the meridional flow. So the meridional flow is very weak. And for the magnetic energy, right now the scaling are not completely obvious, but what we find is that as we make the star rotate faster, we get more magnetic energy to a certain point where we go over super equipartition, like in the geodynamo community, and we can eventually totally quench differential rotation. Okay, so there is one picture when you have no magnetic field, and then there is another picture when you start putting magnetic field and you start increasing the rotation rate. So that's my question. I'm way of answering it.
All right, I think we better finish there. Thank you very much indeed, Sasha. Thank you.